Hello and welcome to recording number 24 of Gary Gygax's Artifact of Evil. Today is August 20th, 2021. Previously, we have the Gord and Gellerin Chert have transported from the realm of the Cat Lord to the top of Tensor's Tower. They've met Tensor. And now he is getting them on their way back after the artifact. He's taken them to the bottom level of his tower, which is situated on the midway, on the near Div, and mid-bay, I should say. And then they are being transported by a water dragon across the near Div. And I'm going to pick up where we left off, on page 222, the last paragraph. Now my friend here agrees to convey you swiftly and safely as far as he can, and there you will be met by others who will see that your journey continues, Tensor said at last. Then he gave each of the three an antique diadem of bronze set with aquamarines and covered with sigils. These enable you to survive underwater for a time, long enough for your journey and then some. Do not breathe while you have these headbands on. Instead, merely relax, and the diomer of these ancient devices will bring clean air into your bodies and remove the used breath. Return them to my servant when you come to the end of your ride. All right, Break, so here they're being given three ancient underwater kind of breathing things. How uncomfortable, I think, to have something that's going to put the fresh air into your lungs and take out the bad, and yet without breathing. I wonder if you shouldn't be, actually moving your lungs at all. That seems a very uncomfortable kind of magic item. All right, I'm going to restart. We're on page 223, second paragraph. The end of the journey came soon enough. The great water dragon swam tirelessly for more than a dozen hours to bring them to their journey's end, at least that portion that was of watery element. The dragon brought them suddenly into open air, writhed ashore, and turning its head to gaze at them with huge eyes, hissed farewell. The silent man signaled for them to dismount, holding out his hand for the diadems. The three complied quickly. Their gear was handed down by the fellow, and then water dragon and rider were gone. Guild folk that were neither Nixies nor aquatic elves, but something similar, yet altogether different, greeted them. Again, this language was silent, merely signals and gestures, whose meaning could not be misunderstood. The adventurers followed their guide to a place in the underground complex of caves, where there was a shining pool of water. These odd creatures signaled for the adventurers to step into the pool. "What does this mean, Gord?" asked the bard. Geller smiled at his two young companions. "I recognize this sort of magic. The pool is attuned to another similar one located elsewhere. In this case, I would suppose the other to be far distant, as Tensor knows we must go, and these are his associates. Our entry will trigger a diomer that will carry us instantly from this pool to the other. Shall we go?" All right, Break. This is seems very similar magic to that used by Curly Greenleaf. In the transportation with the plants, he is able to travel vast differences if he is aware of a similar plant at the end of the journey. So, Curly could be all the way up in the Burnial Forest and be seeing a tree or a plant and use that spell to take him all the way down. The spell doesn't seem to have a distance limitation. It could take him to Greyhawk or further south. or east or west. He just needs to know that there's a plant at the other end. This one has these two pools linked by some means, and it looks like the three of them are going to be transported a great distance. So we have these guild folk. They're not Nixies nor aquatic elves, but something similar. So I'm not quite sure what Gygax means right there. There are maybe just merfolk. I don't know how familiar any of these three are actually with underwater creatures. All right. I'm going to restart. It is page 223 and the fourth paragraph from the end. As the strange underground aquanauts watched with unwinking eyes, the three men stepped into the pool. "All we did was get our feet wetter," Gord muttered as he peered around the grotto. There seemed to be a few more of the strange folk watching them, and perhaps the glowing lichens that illuminated the caves were now emitting more of their phosphors, but that was all the thief could discern. "As I told you, this is a twin of the other Gord. Unless I am a knave and a fool, we are far distant from that place where we were but an eye blink ago." Again, they followed the signs of the guild folk, and in a minute, they were walking along a natural passage that rose steeply upward. The three were alone, and the guild folk gone, puffing from the exertions of the climb. Tired from lack of sleep, they came into the light and open air in a quarter hour or so. A vast body of water extended before them. The sun was overhead. Sails and buildings could be seen off to the right, a mile or two distant. "Right you were," noted Chert with a grin. It was obvious they were somewhere else. How to find out where? "A good time to stretch our legs and dry off," said the bard, laconically, as he finished strapping on weapons and gear. His companions did likewise, and then the three trooped across a boggy meadow until they came to a road a mile distant. There was commerce here, and Geller hailed a passing carter plodding his way up the road from the buildings in the distance. "What city's that?" "Ain't no city at all," the rudely dressed man called in reply. "That there's the town of Crockport," he went on, shaking his head at the total ignorance and foolishness of strangers. "Crockport," Gord said, trying to remember where that place was located. All right, break. So here we have, Chris has put up both the transport via plant spell, which, you know, and then we get Crockport, and I believe it is on the southern tip of Witzel Lake?
Exactly.
All right, so Witzel Lake should be up by the area near Furyundi, I'd guess, or am I wrong there? No, there's...
It's Furyundi, yeah. It's a frontier lake now.
And so to the west is the Vesvi Forest, where everything that's going on, and to the north across the lake is Land of Uz, and to the east is the Horn Society. So, so we're very near the Vesvi, which is exactly where the three needed to be going. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 224 and paragraph 4 from the bottom. "Never heard of it," the barbarian said with a shrug. "It's a frontier town of Furyundi," Geller told them, "located at the southernmost tip of Lake Wistel. That was some pull. We're north of Chendal by 35 leagues and near the eastern edge of the Vesvi." It took longer than expected, but they arrived in the town, tired but dry and cheerful. With a good rest and the acquisition of fast horses, they could be trekking into the fastness of the Vesve forest tomorrow, still with fair prospects of finding Abmi the dwarf and his prize. The place was too close to enemy territory to begin inquiries for friends or allies, but there were good inns and a thriving market. After a meal and some sleep, the three went about equipping themselves for the expedition. All right, break. So we have Crockport here, and it sounds like a fairly busy city. It's a frontier town, according to Geller. So we could expect it to be fairly rough. And, of course, if they hug the coast, they can travel to the west. They would be traveling across the Vesve. But if they go east, they're going to hug the coast on Wistel Lake of Furiundi. Now, they go too far, and it sounds like it's quite a dangerous place. The coast then becomes Horn Society and Land of Uz. So I would expect certainly evil or a neutral merchants traveling out across toward that area. Yeah, and you see it on the Darlene map. Again, it's hard to tell its exact location because the Darlene map is very, vague about exact placement of cities. And directly to the south is Chendal, and 35 leagues looks exactly right because one of Darlene's hexes was supposed to be 30 leagues. Or no, am I right? I'm sorry, is it
it's 30 miles.
30 miles. 30 leagues is over 100 miles.
Right.
Which it could be. It could be even by Darlene's map because it could easily be three hexes, So yeah. I believe it's supposed to be 10 leagues a hex and 30 miles, whereas Anna Myers is supposed to be 12 miles a hex.
Right.
All right. So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely on Darlene's an empty hex, and if we push Crockport further to the north of that and Chendal further to the south, then you can get the 30 leagues, 35 leagues fairly easily. All right. We get a little picture then of what Crockport is like as a frontier town. A busy frontier town, though. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 224 and the last paragraph. More than horses and provisions were needed. Geller sought out a place to purchase maps. They had precious little idea as to the extent and details of what lay within the Vesve. Chert was anxious to find a longbow, and Gord needed missiles for his sling. The bard went off on his errands while the pair of young adventurers sought a weaponeer, hopefully a bower, elsewhere. There were weapons aplenty to be found in Crockport, and in short order, the barbarian found a huge bow that tested even his massive arms. With it and two quivers crammed with broad-headed arrows, each over a yard long, they went on to find Gord's needs. This took a little longer, but eventually they located a place that provided Gord with a variety of weights and sizes of tapering lead bullets for his sling. With a quantity of these missiles stored away, and a pair of well-balanced knives tucked in his boots, the young thief was content. Geller was waiting for them when they returned. There's scant information to be had. But I have a pair of crude maps and information from a hunter who has roamed the forest nearby, he said in clipped tones. Let's be off. What's in the leather bag, Chert? Asked the bard. Geller smiled at that. Long has it been since you've heard me sing and play, Chert, but the lack is cured. There's a fine little harp therein, and I feel far better with such an instrument at hand. With their coursers saddled, and bearing bedrolls and saddlebags of provisions, they rode westward out of Crockport, just after the sun had passed its zenith. They followed a road that turned gradually northward, skirting the edge of the great forest. It was a no man's land that grew wilder and more lonely as they went. The map shows a likely place to spend the night, Geller told his companions. There's a little village that lies a hard day's ride from the town, but if we press our steeds, they'll carry us before much of the dark has been spent. Late in the afternoon, they reached a place where the road split into three tracks. One veered toward the lake, some 10 miles to the east. The central lane continued northward, and the leftmost trail ran westward, angled toward the north. Geller took the latter way and urged his horse to a faster pace. For there was but an hour or two of light remaining, and a long distance yet to go before the village was reached. "We are hunters," said the bard, as he patted a heavy boar spear strapped beside him. The hour was but 2 from midnight, and they were near the village at last. No further caution was needed, and the three proceeded into the community, found a tavern that offered accommodations, and there spent a safe and restful night. The residents were curious to see the strangers, for not many such folk passed their way, at least not many of honest sort, or a group so few in number. They were unmolested, of course, for the three adventurers were obviously tough and capable. Local folk gave them a wide berth, said little, and when the strangers needed anything, they bargained sharply, beginning with exorbitant prices, and grudgingly lowering them to merely outrageous demands. Gord pretended to be in need of a new spear, while Geller and Chirk casually inquired about the most likely area to find the great boars for which the area was famous. The village was in fact called Tushman, or Tusham, in recognition of the number of trophies of long, pointed teeth that decorated its taverns and other establishments. Chert, having hunted the ferocious pigs of his own hills, was eager to discuss the habitats and tricks of the local beasts. There was enough of the same stamp among the rustics of the village, so barbarian and yokels were soon telling tall tales and looking wise. Geller got his additional information, while Gord and Chert ended up buying local boar spears at only slightly inflated prices. A pair of young lads wanted to guide the three adventurers, for there was a famous old boar in the neighborhood. They said it was a devil in pig's hide, actually, but that three skilled hunters, such as these strangers, were, could certainly bring it to bay and slay it. Geller shooed them off, and the trio was soon out of Tusham and heading into the dim Vesvi. Break. I believe it's, though it's not on this map, I believe Tusham may be mentioned in other resources. The name seems familiar to me. And yet it is a small hunting village, I would assume hunting village, near the Vesvi and near the shore. Because they're not exactly in the Vesvi itself, and the forest really runs fairly close up to the shoreline, with just a small area there where there's some open land. And this is the road that ran northwest toward the Vesvi, rather than straight ahead or off toward the coastline of the Wistel Lake. All right. I'm glad they named it. I mean, it's nice when we get this little bit of information. So here's something to add to the lore. Even as the story goes, it fleshes out the village. And this business about the devil pig, that sounds very handy to have as a little adventure that we could link to this village, and how the locals, you know, view this thing. All right, it is page 226 and the final paragraph. They followed a narrow path that wended its way westward into the heart of the spreading forest. After an hour or so, this path diverged, one fork tending toward the south a bit, the other seeming to curve northward. This was the direction desired, and they took the upper trail after a moment of pondering. There were occasional side paths, for here and there, some woodcutter or hunter at his home. As Geller had been told, they came to a hermit's cave in a low cliff that bordered a small woodland stream. The recluse was not to be seen, and after drinking and filling their water skins, they rode on, chewing tough sausages and bits of dried fruit as they went. The path faded into nothingness thereafter, but there were numerous game trails that meandered and crisscrossed. The woodland had been light, with patches of scrub and dense undergrowth where forestation or brush fire had been at work upon its verge. Now the boles were massive, rising to leafy crowns high above, and there limbs intertwined to make the forest floor dim and free of growth above stirrup height. The trails led to an occasional meadow or small clearing at first, but then the little tracks became fewer, and the places where sunlight reached and grass grew scarce. Although the forest was not hard to pass through, it was difficult to keep to a single direction. The sun was hidden, and the trails meandered confusingly between the thick trunks of the forest giants, hip and roan woods dwarfing oaks that were hundreds of years old. Chert was happy here, and both Geller and Gord had sufficient skill at woodcraft to be able to remain on a northerly route. At nightfall, the bard told them they were now in the territory frequented by the herds of wild pigs. They made certain that they were armed with their spears as they made camp and gathered fuel for the fire. Chert slipped away to see if he could find any game for supper in the half hour of purple twilight that remained. He returned with an enormous squirrel whose coat was of sooty hue. His chagrin at having found nothing bigger was changed to unease when the bard told him that such giants as the squirrel he had brought down were a sure sign of evil. They found it tasty anyway, roasted on a spit over the cherry embers of their small fire. You say that such limb lopers as that are found only in forests of eldritch sort, asked Chert again. Why are you surprised at that? The bard countered. You know that the Cambion servants use the heart of the Vesve as a highway, and we are making for that evil core now. It is encouraging to find a creature of that ilk so soon. The trails of Uz must be nearer than I thought. Break. All right, so there is definitely several bits of lore. I mean, I think the most important one is that Uz has trails going through the heart of the Vesve and a sign of evil there. And, you know, the business about the giant squirrels. Unlike Mirkwood, these are actually tasty squirrels, but the Vesve's description is a little similar here to Mirkwood with the covering that is, you know, keeping the plant growth down. Not so blackened, I think, as Mirkwood, which was, you know, completely darkened. There must be a thin enough foliage above to allow some light to make its way through. Now, you know, Geller, of course, has experience, even with these evil passages, where Chert is showing that as a you know, a barbarian of the Adri, he hasn't had that same. Yeah, and the Vesvi does seem very similar to Mirkwood here. I hadn't pictured it that way, so it's good to get this information from Gygax on. Now, of course, here's this forest, it's further north than Furiondi, and it's up near the lands of Uz, so, you know, it's not surprising that it is a dark forest, especially the way that they're going, you know, north of Crockport, and heading more toward the land of Uz.
Yeah, exactly. I never really thought of it as evil, but it makes perfect sense being so close to Uz.
I'd imagine that the southern Vesvi isn't as bad, especially as Furiondi would not want Uz having a complete, you know, to really flank them right up by Chendal, you know, where the forest isn't actually that far away. So I wonder if those trails, go very far west there, and if there is a forest presence. Now, we have that little town of Tushim, which is right, is up there, and that speaks more towards some kind of, if not good, then a neutral presence, and one that isn't overwhelmed by monsters and such. Because, you know, reading about the land of Uz and Duraka, he's really carved out a path, thing of the earth, to represent, like the plains of the abyss. He's got these very hellish, descriptions of the lands up there. And, I imagine the Horn Society isn't much better, although in a more regimented way, because that one of the opposing things is that I believe Uz is chaotic and the Horn Society is lawful.
The Horn Society was neutral.
Well, yeah, I know they're neutral. But are they like lawful neutral? Do they tend toward? Because from Uz's description, it seemed like they were more ordered. And they use hobgoblins. And I believe that the hobgoblins are very very lawful. I might be mistaken, but
that makes sense.
I thought hobgoblins were lawful. And on Anna Meyer's map,
on the other side of the Vesvi, away from the lake, is High Folk. So there is a goodly presence in the forest.
Yeah, but and if we are right about the rises there, then there is, a set of hills or mountains even that are coming up within the Vesvi that do set off the High Folk from, the rest of the forest. If there's a large elven presence in the southern Vesvi, then it really would be a big thorn in the side of Uz. All right. I am going to restart. It is page 227, and it is the second paragraph from the end. Gord, not at all disturbed about the nature of the rodent, was thinking of the great swine that made their home in the area. And the wild boars. What about the tale of one who is diabolical, he asked. Devils and demons don't mix, as they say, Geller said, with a small shrug. Still, perhaps the beast could be some form of demon, possessed or in swine form, or even a were form of that sort. Let us hope that we can avoid confrontation with a boar of any kind. If not, then we must slay quick and sure. There are more important things we must accomplish than sticking pigs, mundane or supernatural. Let it be a plain old tusker, exclaimed Chert enthusiastically. Second key or no, a big tusker roasted over an open fire is a dish I haven't tasted in far too long. Geller had been only half listening as the giant hillman spoke of such feasting. Without commenting, Geller quietly opened the leather bag, with its little harp nestled upon the velvet that lined it. He sat back, ran his fingers experimentally across the silver strings, and made rippling melodies play across the silver play around the firelit little clearing. Both young men watched and listened in fascination. Geller left off the runs and rills, playing instead a melody and singing a ballad that bespoke the camaraderie and gladness of a forest camp at the coming of night. The song lasted for minutes. Before it concluded, two forms emerged from the shadowy dark just beyond the edge of the campfire's light and joined the listeners. All right, break. It is page 228 and the end of paragraph 20. All right, so we get Geller playing his harp. It seems to me maybe he is actually enacting some kind of magic to protect them in their camp, or else give the character some kind of charm. All right, I'm going to restart. It is chapter 21, page 229, the first paragraph. While Gord and his companion sought the evil dwarf, Abmi, deep in the Vesve forest, events elsewhere began to lead toward a resolution of the matter. Somewhere in the mountains to the west, a great citadel stood, carved from the basalt and obsidian of the peaks themselves. The fortress was cloaked magically, so that only a few knew where it stood, and fewer of those dared go near it. Within the sprawling complex were many sorts of folk, including the dwarven miners who dug the rich veins of platinum from the depths of the massifs, and the gnomish smiths who beat it into coins of finely wrought jewelry. Others, men and elves, carried the product of the mining and crafting further west into Pereland and Ket, southward to High Folk and Valuna, and east into the sprawling kingdom of Furiundi. The citadel was the demesne of Mordenkainen, and the various folk were all who owed him their liege. The affairs of others seldom interested the Archmage, but of late he had been troubled by news from his agents. These included spies who roamed the domain of Uz, and actually entered the dreaded city of Doraka, or rode the plains of the Hierarchs, and drank in the sinks of Molag. All said that evil bestirred itself. There were rumors of concerted effort, and even strange flashes of power in the cosmos. Mordenkainen took heed of these. Emissaries of magical and ordinary type as well went forth to alert heads of state and other cryptic groups and powerful individuals to what the Archmage had learned. With them went a pledge of assistance and a promise to resist the growing coalition of malign forces. The knowledge sent hinted most abstrusely at the existence of the tripartite artifact and its first key. Those who were great in knowledge of arcane and recondite subjects knew then that the world stood in great peril. Back came more bits and pieces of information and assurances of cooperation. The elven folk of High Folk and their nominal subjects within the edges of Vesve Forest made alliance with Mordenkainen and the force called the Obsidian Citadel. Seldom had they quarreled anyway, and the Archmage's vassals included many tribes of wild Grugok and Wood Elves. Agents came and went from secret places, bearing more secret communications. It happened that one of these agents managed to bring Uz his first intelligence regarding the artifact of all evil, and alert the Cambion as to the likely whereabouts of the second key. Thus Abmi, the worst of Uz's secret six, managed to find the item where it was hidden in the lost temple. The host raised by the Scarlet Brotherhood, meanwhile, had floundered through the Sus Forest and upward to the Whelkwood. Confused and slow, they had been harassed by the woodsmen and elves in the process of their march. Furious at their inability to locate something already far beyond their reach, the brothers gathered a still greater force. Goblins and hobgoblins, and any other of the vicious humanoids who could be found, were conscripted to fight beside the bandits, brigands, and scum who served as auxiliaries for the main body. This army was composed of the highly trained and rigidly disciplined regiments of the Brotherhood. Its advance guard was 1,000 strong, and behind that regiment were 4 others. Such size was actually why the force was ineffective. It was increased by the addition of thousands of men and humanoids. So large a horde could not fail but to attract attention. The army had to eat, and its scurvy auxiliaries had to slay and burn. The whole thing rolled northward slowly, and then turned away from the forests to stab into the pastoral countryside of Selene. The elvish monarchy was awaiting. They fell upon the horde almost immediately, and a great pitched battle raged for 2 days afterward. There fell the Marshal of Selene, Lord Parsifal. With him many other noble elves and men were slain as well. Else spellcasters fought spellcaster. The plying of bow and spear, sword and axe, took the worst toll. Of the cousins, nephews, and brothers of the Scarlet Sign, there was a great slaughter. Afterwards, their regiments had no heart, and fought fiercely, but without direction. So they died. Brigand companies and allied humanoids simply melted away. Fleeing this way or that, those that went east back to the Whelkwood were ambushed or hunted down and then exterminated. In this manner, an assassin, sometimes known as Blanc, was brought low by Deirdre, a lady knight of Hardby, while the great company of outlaws whom he had led was slain to a man by the banner of riders and footmen who served her. Some few managed to remain alive by fleeing north or south. Those who escaped to the south eventually returned to the Pomarge to tell of the terrible battle. Those who went northward found another fate. All right, break a bunch of others. Now, of the high folk here. And I'm not sure where exactly, but...
In there, it's in the Yattles. There's a fortress, and that's the Obsidian Citadel.
All right, of Morden Kanan's. All right, I had thought the Obsidian Citadel... wasn't the name of Morden Kanan's castle, but actually an organization, but I'm not sure.
Could be both.
That's true. And as Morden Kanan is, you know, like the focal point for the Circle of Eight, it sounds more likely that the Obsidian Citadel would be actually the name of his fortress. So now we've seen Tensor's fortress, and we're being told a little about Morden Kanan's. All right, and then as the story's going, we're hearing about the battles going in the south in Saline, and that the Scarlet Brotherhood forces seem to have met general defeat down there. Now, when they did the Greyhawk Wars, they of course had the Scarlet Brotherhood as successful, but you keep hearing here that for the most part, they depended a lot on auxiliary troops to, you know, flesh them out. They had a main battle force of highly trained Scarlet Brotherhood forces, but you know, they also had plenty of these bandits and scum and such, and plenty of humanoids. They always like using humanoids, the Scarlet Brotherhood. So, you know, it's hard to tell. I think like in the Greyhawk Wars box set, they had these big nationwide battles that really caused great campaign destruction here and a big change. But I don't think Gygax would have been into that too much. As we get this description here, Saline survives, but there's battles and forces are killed and heroes are killed. But at the same time, Saline seems able to drive off the Scarlet Brotherhood force. And so that would weaken their hold, on the Pomarge, because it would have to be the Pomarge where they were getting so many Scarlet Brotherhood troops so quickly, I would guess. But at the same time, none of this really is throwing, the nations of the Flaness into, complete change and turmoil. So I think we would see with Gygax warfare, certainly, but not this this giant warfare where whole nations were destroyed.
Why would the Scarlet Brotherhood go into Saline? It doesn't make sense to me.
Yes, I mean, while they're trying to track down the artifact, they have to know that what they're doing is it's doing nothing for them to chase after those with the artifact. Instead, it's actually helping whoever had the artifact, and they have no loyalty to anyone but themselves. They want that artifact. They want to reawaken Tharizdun. So it seems very strange that they would reinforce the group that was following to the point where they're fighting major battles instead of trying to make their way north as quickly as possible.
I wonder if they mistook Saline's neutrality for pacifism.
I don't know, because Saline is so close to the Pomarge. I don't know. I would doubt that. I would think that Saline has to have a very dangerous reputation, because you got to remember their big defensive line is just the forest, and I think for that to be an effective defense, they have to be very proactive about anyone entering that forest and anyone crossing near to Saline. I doubt once they cross the Jewel to the west, I would imagine it becomes very, very heavily patrolled in Saline. It's just my idea from what we've been reading here, is that I would assume that the Jewel River to the west must be some kind of like deadline, and those who cross over better have good reason or an invitation or face these these patrols of elves. They also have their flying hippogriffs, and that gives them a very very good way to quickly patrol their borders and to see, especially coming through the forest, any approach of a large army is going to make itself very well known trying to cross through the Sus Forest down there, or even more northerly, trying to cross through the Whelkwood. Now, with the Whelkwood, I get the idea that it is actually is like the Adri, where there's forest folk that are definitely in there. And with Saline, there may be some occupation of the Suss Forest on the west side of the Jewel, but definitely the east of the Jewel seems to be fairly wild and unpopulated by, you know, various towns or, you know, forest folk or elven folk of any sort. But the Whelkwood seems different. The Whelkwood, a little further north, that seems to have its own interior population. So, yeah, I don't understand why the Scarlet Brotherhood would turn to open warfare and then come out of the forest into Selene. Now, Verbabonk seems much a much lesser, you know, much less strong place for, you know, such a force to try to go through. And I've never imagined Verbabonk as being particularly strong past its city itself. So it is very strange that they would cross and into Selene in a large force. But, you know, the Scarlet Brotherhood does seem to have a good dose of overconfidence.
Yeah, it must have just been a matter of expediency. It's the fastest way.
Yeah. It says that they were confused and slow and harassed by woodsmen and elves in the process of their march.
So they were being harried.
I'm sorry, I may be jumping ahead right here. I'm sorry. But anyway.
Okay.
All right. And, okay, I think this is actually going to answer some, unless I...
It does.
No, we read this. Okay. This was the paragraph on 230 here, the second from the bottom, where it says that as they went through the Suss, they were floundering, and then into the Whelkwood, they were confused and slow and harassed by woodsmen and elves. And then they were furious about not being able to locate the second artifact, and gathered a greater force, and then tried to punch their way through Selene. And instead, you know, they end up crossing into the open land, the pastoral countryside of Selene, but the elvish monarchy was awaiting and fell upon the horde. So it sounds like, again, this is because of the Scarlet Brotherhood, even though they're supposed to be organized, they certainly don't seem to be very strategically sound thinkers here. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 231, and it is the third paragraph from the end. At the northern edge of the Cron Hills, where the fringe of the great gnarly forest sent no more of its briars and oaks toward the setting sun, stand the ruins of a large building. Once active, the place is now generally shunned, for another battle was fought near it, and its builders slain or gone in defeat. The place is, of course, the temple of elemental evil. Its ruin, rather, as any local serf or peasant farm boy from the neighborhood could tell you. Other than occasional groups of adventurous explorers seeking forgotten treasure, nobody goes to the temple. Bad, evil things haunt the place still. All right, break. Now, I wanted to break right here because, well, you know, here's the mention in the temple elemental evil. But it also, if you notice what Gygax is saying, the information he's giving, always we talk unreliable narrator, and here, who's giving this information? Well, from what Gygax says in this passage, this is just the general knowledge of serfs or peasant farm boys. So, you know, we're not getting any kind of thing like this. Isn't like Tenser or Mordenkainen or Geller, even, who's saying this about the temple. This is coming just from local farm boy knowledge or serfs. So, this is extraordinarily unreliable information. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 231, second paragraph to the end. this very place came a company of another sort, goodly clerics, stout cavaliers and soldiers too, and a magic user or two as well. They came because a dire warning said that some being of great evil still lurked there, imprisoned in the temple, about to be loosed. They traveled quickly and with grim purpose. They were greeted by a mass of fugitives. These evil men and malign humanoids were spoiling for revenge, and they lay in wait for the company. These outlaws had strong, fearsome leaders now, folk from the hidden places beneath the temple, and others too. They fought to kill the clerics and knights and all the rest. The evil leaders left them, though, and as most of their fellows had done earlier, these survivors did now. They were killed on the field. The battle, small and brief as it actually was, comparatively speaking, took its toll on the company. There was a delay for meditation and prayers, for healing and rest, to prepare for the entry into the Temple of Elemental Evil. Time had been purchased at a price held cheap and meaningless by those within the place. A great personage, an ancient magus, a feared and mighty one of Eld, had come among the few who still remained within the precincts of the ruin. She it was who set the ambush, brought the delay, and gained the time for her ends. The company came, ready again to face any foe of evil nature. Into the temple they came, driving all before them. Downward they plunged, sending undead things back to the pits from which they came, destroying the lurking monsters who would otherwise prey upon mankind. Deep and deeper they went, seeking what they knew they must find. Even as they finally discovered the confining place and readied for the great confrontation, a pair of ghastly figures sprang upward, passing through stone and earth as if it were air. Too late had these arch clerics and doughty fighters come. Yggville, mother of evil, had come before them and freed the demoness Zuckmoy. But as these minions of good lamented their failure, there were those not allied to evil who rejoiced at Yggville's success. Warden Kanan, one who had secretly aided the plan to free the monstrous demoness, was among them. 13 stone chairs stand above the many lesser seats in the Hall of Dread and Molag. 5 to either hand are smaller and lower than the 3 in the center. 13 thrones for the 13 hierarchs, the dread and awful presences who rule the Horn Society. Only 3 of the chairs were empty. The trio of the tallest thrones remained vacant as the hierarchs took their places, 5 to the right, 5 to the left. Officials and military officers filed in to stand below the thrones. Down the aisle, left unusually broad by the press of lesser masters of the Horn Society, humanoid chieftains, bandit leaders, all wafted a terrible stench. As the foul odor came, the ranks compacted tighter still, and a wide space was made wider by this movement. Behind the decaying stink came something from which eyes turned away in revulsion. Before the throne, the ten hierarchs, came Anthraxis the Decayed, Daemon King of Hades. It is worthy of note that the 10 who sat upon the stone chairs did not avert their eyes as the monstrous figure glided toward them. All right, break. I'm kind of caught in the middle here because I thought we were going to hear a little bit more about Morden Kanan, because just before this, about the hierarchs, we're getting that Morden Kanan secretly aided the plan to free Zuckmoy. So, you know, I mean, Gygax runs his own campaign, but that goes beyond the story into the realm of lore, because you have to wonder what motivations would Gygax, have put on Morden Kanan that he would want to aid Zuckmoy. I didn't Morden Kanan being more of a neutral than a an evil character.
That's probably exactly it. maybe he's more capable of reading that magic, the fabric of magic that Tenser was talking about. Maybe he sees that doing this will do something else. I'm just guessing, of course.
That's what I'd say. I mean, he is a neutral, and he's not necessarily going to act in ways that would, aid nations or wouldn't cost lives if he sees that is something greater in his, in his own self-interest or in the self-interest of those within his own organization. So the release of Zuchtmoy, he may see something where it's better if us and the Hierarchs are in more balance when they confront each other. So, but that's all guesswork. It's a very interesting little piece there that just a slight mention with no explanation of why that would be. But here we have Morden Kanan very interested in seeing the freeing of Zuchtmoy. And then instead of just the adventurers or Robilar freeing Zuchtmoy, we actually have that it is Yggdrasil who is the one to do it. Now, Chris has posted the stats and picture from Monster Manual 2 of Anthraxis, the Oinodaimon, but who is also in this book considered the King of Hades, which I believe, would put him above Nerl. Now, in a sense, he's introduced here, but he seems very much like Incabulus, but I believe Incabulus is probably a Sul deity. All right. So we have this talk of the structures here, and it seems that the Hierarchs really are having incredibly powerful help coming. Now, Nerl is a Flannish god of the dead, whereas Anthraxis is a daemon. Even if he's maybe chief of the daemons, his statistics are incredibly high in Monster Manual 2. His intelligence is godlike. He is, while he's not considered here, I think, to be quite a deity, most of these demons, devils, and daemons, they have so much power that they can control and send this flux that Tenser was talking about of power back to their clerics and worshipers. There's a lot more to get into right here about, and we're just approaching this whole section, and I'm very interested because we're going to hear about what's going on with the Hierarchs and Nerl and the situation. But we are at 6:58, and I think it's probably a good point here. There's but a single Daemon Master and Lord of the Middle Planes. And that currently is Anthraxis. And that's something, of course, to keep in mind, is that this these leaders and controllers of various planes, they do switch among any of them, in the Abyss, in Hades, the demons, the devils, and the daemons. They do rise and fall in power. So
they're constantly fighting each other. So.
Yes, and we'll get into that much, much deeper in once we get into Sea of Death, but maybe even by the end of Artifact of Evil, although we are closing in on this book very rapidly. We are on page 233 already. So just today, I think we've covered 10 more pages. It's a 352-page book, so we are down to about 120 pages left. And we're going to cover that pretty quickly, I think. So I suspect this is not going to go on as long as Saga of Old City. This has been a very enjoyable book, but we've covered a lot of things a lot of action sequences and a lot of story. Very exciting story that has passed by. Not quite as much lore. Now, one of the things right here, we are getting a great deal of lore. That business with Mordenkainen helping, that is story and lore combined. It's well beyond, you know, it's definitely part of Gygax's setting material. But it's not necessarily the way things go. In the modules, this wasn't the way things happened. But, you know, for what Gygax is doing right here, we have Zuckmoy freed by Yggdrasil. Makes much more sense to me that it would take someone of the power of Yggdrasil to set Zuckmoy free. All right. I think that should be where we're going for tonight. All right. Good night, Chris. I'm going to call up Craig, and I'm going to kick him out. And this was the 24th recording. All right, night, everyone.